What is consciousness, and how does it operate? I have been intrigued and interested in this since I was a kid, actually, trying to imagine what it would be like to see the world through the eyes of my cat, or a bird, or my friend Rex down the street. In 1973, this abiding interest of mine took a more deliberate turn. Late one Sunday afternoon, this slightly beat up golden Rolls Royce drove up the driveway next to the parsonage where I was living. And this was in rural Massachusetts. Car came up there, and this man with his big fuzzy beard and sparkly eyes stepped out. At that time, I was the minister of the Unitarian Universalist congregation there in town. It was my first congregation after graduating from theological school. The edifice of that church had been built during the American Revolutionary War, which is prehistory out here in California. So it was one of those classical white clapboard churches with a tall steeple that sat up high on the town common. The sanctuary, and it sat probably about 250 people. And on Sunday mornings when I was there, we got somewhere, we averaged about 5 or 10. So someone said to me, Doug, you ought to invite some spiritual heavy to come talk at the church. And I said, well, like who? And this person said, well, how about Ram Dass? Well, I had a copy of his book, Be Here Now, and I had thumbed through it a couple times, so I had a sort of vague sense of his reputation, but not much more. But I looked around and I found an address for him. And so I wrote him a letter. Yes, this was before the internet. I wrote him a letter, and I was, I won't say shocked, but was really surprised when he wrote back and said, yeah, he'd love to come. So, as Ram Dass stepped out of his dad's Rolls Royce, I stepped out of the parsonage and invited him to come in for light supper before we went over to the church. Later, when we entered the sanctuary, there must have been 300 people crammed into that building. And I quickly, just reflexively, I looked up. There were these four steel cables that were attached to the rafters that came through the ceiling and went all the way down to hold the joist to the floor. The floor was attached to the walls and suspended on these cables. And I looked at those cables and I thought, there's probably more weight in this building than there's been in here in about 150 years. Well, the building held together just fine. And Ram Dass held everybody's attention just fine with his stories and musings and chants and meditation and just slightly otherworldly aura about him. The next day when I was reflecting on it evening, I thought, I finally met somebody who knew a little bit of something about consciousness. I didn't feel like I'd met anybody that knew much of anything, but he may have known a little bit. And he seemed to indicate that he thought meditation was very important. And at that particular time, I had probably meditated as long as 15 or 20 minutes, and certainly not on a regular basis. So I wrote him another letter, and I said, if I wanted to get some meditation training, where would be a good place to go? And he wrote back and he said, there's this brand new retreat facility there in Western Massachusetts that you probably ought to check out. It's called the Insight Meditation Society. So I got a hold of them and I signed it up for a 2-week retreat. I figured that would build up enough momentum to get me going. And the teacher of that retreat, somebody I hadn't heard of before, her name was Ruth Dennison. At the end of that retreat, after those 2 weeks, I thought that was the most meaningful thing I had done in my whole life. And I was glad that I would never have to do that again. But I did. After that, I found myself meditating like about 45 minutes a day. And I went back for another 2 week retreat the next year and the year after and the year after. And I've done at least one retreat a year, some years, many more than that for ever since then. That was about 50 years ago. And in the process, I trained with lots of different teachers and lots of different traditions. I really like the Theravada meditation instructions. And it was real clear to me that it wasn't because they were best instructions. It was just clear that they just really suited me well. But at the same time, I really liked the Mahayana description of how the practice worked. During those early years, first 25 years, I probably did pretty exclusively one-pointed concentration. One of the teachers I studied with a lot there was Larry Rosenberg, who was the teacher in Cambridge, Massachusetts at the Insight Center there. And one retreat he introduced me, not me alone, but all of us, to the jhanas that I hadn't heard of before. In 2000, I moved from Massachusetts out here to the Sacramento area. And shortly after that, John Travis became my root teacher, my main teacher. Am I doing okay with the microphone? I'm trying to rotate my voice box around it. So I began training with John, and I traveled in India a couple times, spent a couple weeks meditating in Thailand. Couple of months meditating in Thailand. And later on, John introduced me to this American monk named Bhante Vimala Ramsey, who taught a version of the jhanas that was based on metta, some metta-based jhana practice, and really emphasized a wide open awareness rather than one point of concentration. Jhanas are Thank you for that. Keep interrupting me. It's jhanas, the best way to describe them is the Buddha laid out a path that went from ordinary awareness to full enlightenment. They went through a series of stages. They were called jhanas. So a lot of people call them states of meditative absorption, but they really not, that's not the key thing. There's a whole wisdom factor, and you have to have a wide open awareness to cultivate wisdom, because wisdom has to do with seeing how things operate together. So thanks for that. And feel free to interrupt me at any point. I'd rather have a dialogue anyway. So using these metta-based jhanas, my practice just took off in a way that I hadn't thought was really possible for somebody like me. So I've been doing those for a while, and then just a couple of years ago, I came across the work of Yak Pangsep. Is anybody familiar with him? I thought probably not. He is a scientist. He's an Estonian-American scientist who taught out of University of Washington for a long time. And he coined the term effective neuroscience for the study of a brain and emotion. And I was very intrigued with this stuff. And as I got to understand it, I could see that modern science had a very, very different view of the mind and the brain than what I had learned in my meditation training. And working with a brain, it's just a lot more complex and counterintuitive. But to me, it felt like I had spent years studying cars, but usually from a distance, or maybe from sitting behind the driver's wheel. But I had never actually opened up the hood and looked at an engine underneath. And when I did and looked at the brain, it was just a different universe. There was no polished steel, no levers and dials and buttons. There is just this dull gray steel covered with grease and a little bit of dirt and wires sticking out in all directions and little gadgets screwed on here and there. In a similar way, the language of meditation and the language of neuroscience are just very different. Meditation speaks about mindfulness and awareness and metta and jhanas and sampajana and nirodha and more. Neuroscience talks about neurons, myelin sheathing, the brain, error correction, entropy, Bayesian inference, amygdala, on and on and on. They're just different galaxies. But I've been looking at this hard for a couple of years, and what I began to comprehend a little bit of what's shown up in brain research in the last, particularly about the last 50 years, I began to see all that stuff showing up in my meditation practice. It wasn't that it hadn't been there before, but it gave me a new view of things. And there were some things that were complex or hard to work with that it really cleared up. And the language and the concepts are just alien to meditation. And indeed, my impression was that the neuroscientists I was studying, none of them meditated. There was no sign of that. But I could keep finding what they were talking about in my practice. And as I did that, I found my practice was just going a lot deeper. There was just a whole different way of approaching this stuff that I had never come across. So this evening, what I wanted to talk to you about is what I would call the wellsprings of consciousness and the implications, particularly the implications that it has for meditation, because I haven't seen any crossover from these two fields, and I think it's got a lot that's very practical that could deepen our practice. But it's a huge topic, and we just have a little bit of time. So I thought what would be most helpful if I would just focus in on what are called the affective emotions, what they are, how they work, and how they show up in meditation, and how to really leverage them to get our practice to go deeper and quieter. And to begin that, I would just start with a simple question. How does consciousness arise? What is it made of? What are its ingredients? The Buddha put all those into just one simple question. What are the causes and conditions that give rise to consciousness? And the neuroscience has demonstrated, I think quite convincingly, that one of the essential ingredients, one of the central conditions that needs to be there for consciousness are these affective emotions. So affective emotions are emotions that don't arise out of interaction with other people. They're ones that come right out of the body. And they give us a measure of how well or how poorly we're doing. So if I ask you, how are you doing inside? You probably don't tell me about your spleen and your stomach or your knee joints. You probably give some measure of how good or how poorly your life seems to be going at this particular moment. Those are affective emotions. And so one thing to understand about them is that they are completely 100% subjective. Only I can know what my affective emotions are. Only you can know yours. And I can look at you and I know what it feels like to smile, so I see you smiling. And so I make some inferences about what you might be feeling, but it may not be because you're feeling happy. Maybe you're feeling embarrassed, or when a baby smiles, you know, maybe it's because of gas. You know? So it's very easy to misread these. Still, in the last half century, neuroscientists have learned a lot about how these operate in the brain. You should have little sheets of paper, and I've listed on those 7 effective emotions. These are the ones that have been studied a lot and demonstrated. And I just wanted to give them to you on a sheet of paper, so you don't try to memorize these, so you've got them all. The first thing that they found out about these is that they are hardwired into the lower parts of the brain, basically by the forces of evolution. I'd always thought that consciousness would arise out of the neocortex. It's the more advanced part of the brain. But this is where we think and cogitate and wonder and figure things out. But they're actually come out of the lower brain. And if you go in, so they found this little tiny places that are the centers of each of these. And if you go in and take out all 7 of those, either anesthetize the area, or as I do with animals sometimes, go in with little scalpels and just scramble the tissue in there. If you take out all the affective emotions, the creature drops into a coma. There's just no awareness whatsoever. And in contrast, if you remove the neocortex, birds and mammals and people can actually do relatively well. Jaak Panksepp actually, he's the one who did a lot of the cutting edge research on it, but there are just many more scientists that are working on it now. But he got a rat and opened it up and took out the whole neocortex and sewed it back up, and then gave the rat to, one at a time, to 16 of his graduate neuroscience students, along with the second rat that had all its gray matter. And what he asked them to do was just spend about a half an hour observing these two animals, and then let him know which one they thought had a neocortex and which one was decorticated. And 12 of the 16 people, 75%, said that the decorticated rat was the one that had its full brain. And apparently this was because the fully intact creature was more aware and more sensitive and tended to cower in the corner, while the decorticated rat explored more, preened, cared for others, played, was curious, etc. It was just much more active. So these students, yes?
I have a question.
Sure.
You said the lower part of the brain, are you like talking about the
subconscious mind? It's making the difference between the brain and the mind. So it's the lower part of the brain. It's the more ancient parts. There's the brain stem, and then it grows out and up from there. So it's the midbrain and the lower brain, as opposed to the neocortex. It's much older evolutionarily and much more primitive. In terms of unconscious, that's a whole different deal. Like I say, if you take out all the affective emotions, there's nothing left but unconsciousness. It's really, really startling. So far as I know, no one has decorticated a human being. But there are children, there are rare examples of children who are born without a neocortex. What seems to happen is that the fetus probably had a stroke in utero, which took out the blood supply to the upper part of the brain. So the condition is called hydrocephaly. It means water on the brain. And what happens in these children is there is just cerebral spinal fluid where there's supposed to be a neocortex. And these children, they don't have real speech. They don't seem to be able to have speech without a neocortex. And they had some other disabilities, but they were curious and they laughed and they learned from experience and expressed fear and played and fully conscious. So to be sure, mammals and birds, in mammals and birds and humans, the neocortex is wired in many different ways with these affective emotions. That's it's a whole interdependent web of neural wiring, so that the neocortex can suppress or enhance or shape those affective emotions. But without those subcortical affective emotions, there really is no awareness at all, no consciousness at all. So what I would like to do is explore the affective emotions, how to recognize them, how relating to them wisely can deepen our meditation practice and actually enrich our lives in lots of different ways. How are we doing on time? Okay. As I said, there are 7 distinct ones that have been mapped out and studied extensively. And they're connected to the other parts of the nervous system. But for purposes of elucidation, you can talk about them separately. Yak Pangsep gives each of these a common name, which are the ones you have there in capital letters. And he likes to capitalize them to say that that's kind of the general area, but there's actually a specific scientific understanding of that. And so on your list, and there should be one in the chat room for those who are online, you'll see these: seeking, rage, fear, lust, care. You know, we are as infants, we are so incredibly helpless that unless there is a strong instinct to care for others, we just wouldn't survive. And I assumed along the ways there have been people who have less caring, you know, their genes just don't get passed along so easily. Lust, care, connection. Yes. Sure.
Actually, could people be born without some of these
Affective emotions.
Yeah. Like, potentially, could they be born without some, or potentially grown into having some, or is it an actual thing that they have?
They are wired into all of us unless there's been some damage, but I think it's like any other human trait. They can be stronger or weaker in some people and others. I mean, certainly as we look around, we see some people just, you know, are born, they seem to be missing a few pieces here and there. And while we have all of them, like rage is something we all experience, but it doesn't mean we necessarily have to express it. But we can't not feel it. We can numb it out and pretend it's not there. And part of what you learn from meditation is that the stuff you can see clearly, you just relate to with more wisdom. Okay. So let me just say this generally about them. What I have found, and where I came into all this, is that when I was sitting and meditating, you know, there are times when the mind just sort of runs off with a storyline or gets, you know, caught in an argument with somebody who's going out and doing all kinds of things. And I can, you know, try to relax that, but the mind sometimes just spins on. And what I started to do when I was beginning to study this stuff is just look and see in those hindrances, in those mind wanderings, if I could see any affective emotions in them. So if there was seeking, which is just, seeking describes what happens to, it's sort of like curiosity, that what happens in humans and mammals and birds is that if there's something that's totally novel in the environment, if they're not feeling threatened by it, there's this natural desire to learn more about it. And you can see the evolutionary advantage of that, of getting to know the environment around you at times when you're not under threat. So if I saw seeking there, I would just look at that seeking. If I saw rage or fear or anxiety, I would just let go of everything else in the storyline and just let my awareness go right to that affective emotion. And this is a key part to it, relaxed into it. Okay. I may seem counterintuitive, but if you look at the Buddha's core teachings, Four Noble Truths, right? The first one says there is suffering. There's three lines to each of them. There is suffering. Suffering is to be understood. And then he says, suffering has been understood by me, meaning if you want to get what I got, this is part of the way I got there. And understand there doesn't mean a Freudian psychological analysis. It means just seeing how suffering operates, how it arises, hangs around for a while, and then fades. Okay. And then the second noble truth says that there is tension. Tanha is a Pali term. There is tension. And the practice that goes with it is very dramatic. He said, tension is to be abandoned. How do you abandon tension? You relax. And abandon, I think, just means don't mess around with it. Don't analyze. You can understand the suffering. You don't have to understand the tension. Just relax. And the difficulty is that in English, the term relax can be slightly aversive. Relax, man, you know, let it go. It can have that little bit of pushing away. So I like to call it relaxing into. So suffering is to be understood. To understand something, you have to turn towards it and see it. So in my meditation practice, that's how I translate that. Something comes up that's, you know, bother me, rather than push it away, I let my attention go to it. And then the next thing is to see if there's any tension in it, and if it is, relax it. And so you can do that with all kinds of things that are coming up, but I found, and I practiced this for years, but I found that when I saw one of those affective emotions and turned towards it and relaxed into it, the mind would go peaceful about three times faster. So you can see from the neuroscience, if awareness and consciousness comes out of those affective emotions, they're all built on top of it. If you take out the ones at the bottom, the whole thing collapses and the mind goes into a deep kind of abiding peacefulness. Does that make sense? So what I'd like to do, good, we still have about half an hour left. There's a couple different things we could do. One is we could split up into small groups, do breakout groups there. I got one no from that just right at the beginning. Groups usually don't like to do that. What I would do with that is ask you to look through these and see which ones feel real familiar to you in your practice and how you relate to them. That's one option. Another option is I can just talk a little bit longer about, go into detail with one or two of these affective emotions. We won't have time to go through all of them, but I could do that. The third thing we could do is just go right straight to questions, but you seem to be doing that okay already.
I'd love to hear you talk about rage and fear.
Okay. Any other votes?
I just wanted to make sure I was straight on the sort of overarching.
Sure.
So, I think I might be mixed up. I don't, you didn't say this, but I'm just wondering, is there a sense in which the...
Rage and fear.
Oh boy, wow, okay. Why don't I wait and turn it off and then... Somebody on there? 1, 2. Okay. Still feels like super loud.
So okay, Doug, can just we pull the people down from the ceiling?
Yeah, there we go. Okay, so just, is there a sense in which that we should think of these something like hindrances? Or no, this is like orthogonal?
Yes, no, that's, am I on here? Boop. Is my microphone on? Oh, okay. Yes, I just have a thing about the hindrances, which I would say is the hindrances show up when there's something that needs more attention. And so the art of the hindrances is actually to figure out how to work with them.
All right, that's what we do on retreat.
Yeah, and also I would say turning towards and relaxing into, because there's a tendency with the hindrances, you know, to treat them like the devil incarnate or something like that.
Boop, 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 boop. Okay.
I just have this kind of reverse paranoia way of looking at all this stuff, that hindrances draw our attention to things that really need some more attention. It's just that a system is not necessarily inherently wise about how to do that. So we have to bring the wisdom to it. And that's what those, I think, core Buddhist teachings were about, was turning towards and relaxing into, rather than try to push away. If there's something scary and you push it away. 1, 2, okay. So we're trying to illustrate the hindrances here.
Well, I didn't want to derail you onto something else. I just thought it might be helpful as we enter some sort of practice or a deeper discussion on one, and see how, like, this practice that you're mapping out with the neuroscience may just come up from an experiential standpoint. You know, we're leading into these things, but oftentimes these things are other things that maybe, can be difficult or sick.
Right.
And you're saying,
yeah, and I would say if it feels difficult. I was talking about different ways of working with hindrances and other difficulties. And what I would say is if a feeling of difficulty comes up in your practice, look at the feeling itself. Don't get entangled with the content. You know, the stories will go on forever. We are bred to look at content. We don't need any help looking at content. Look at the process. I'm worrying, I'm fretting, I'm arguing, I'm defending. See what the verbs are that are going on, and then relax into those, particularly when you feel the tension in them.
Would you get kind of stuck in it a little bit?
If you get hooked on the content. See, the option is to either actively or passively push it away. And there's a couple problems with that. Is one, pushing away is pushing more energy into it. And also that thinking is one of the ways that human beings evolved about dealing with difficult situations. So when there's a problem out there, you know, we don't have big claws or big teeth or something. What we have is these big brains to try to figure out what to do with that. So you'll notice sometimes you may be feeling, you know, very mellow. When some problem comes up, the mind starts spinning. So if you treat the hindrances as difficulties that you have to get rid of, what you're doing is you're signaling to the brain that this is a problem and you need to think about it. And so the mind will just start spinning on it, and then you try to push that away and it spins more and spins more. So you kind of have to do it a keto move with it. Okay, okay. So are we back to rage? Does somebody have those questions there? Okay, well, I'll go on this, and then we'll go back and pick that up as we. Oh, I need to call on somebody. Who do I call? Oh, Helen.
Hi, Doug. We missed what happened with some of the answers and questions on Zoom. We couldn't hear. When the mic isn't there, it's hard for us to know. Was there a decision made about the three choices?
No.
No.
Yes. Okay. Well. Well, we'll spend the rest of the evening deciding what we'll do with the rest of the evening. the thing that I thought that got the most enthusiasm was for me to talk in more depth about. Okay.
And so that. Okay, and Clyde has a question from the Zoom group. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Helen. Hi, Clyde.
Hi, Doug. When you were talking about the seeking, mm-hmm. it sounded to me like curiosity. Is that right? And is that then curiosity an effective emotion?
Good question. Yes, it does appear as curiosity, but it's a little broader than that. If you are in a building that's burning down and the mind starts spinning through trying to figure out what an exit is, that would be called seeking too, but that doesn't have the same tone as curiosity. But it is that business of trying to figure something out, trying to figure a pathway through it. And curiosity probably is the most familiar way that it manifests. Okay, are we back to rage? I'm really glad you brought this up because I think rage is probably one of the most difficult topics for meditators. Because I mean, we're Buddhist, you know, we don't do that type of stuff. So let me tell you a story. I have 6 or 8 Dhamma talks that are out on YouTube. And in YouTube, you know, right after the talk or the video thing, there's a place where you can leave comments. Okay. And I have it set up so that when people leave a comment for me, and I'm sure most of the people don't leave a comment, but when they do, it's automatically emailed to me. So I'll get a few of these every week or something like that. I imagine Jack Kornfield or Tara Brach or something, they couldn't set up, they'd just be flooded. But so I got this comment from somebody, like I say, most of them are nice, etc. But this one, he said, this person is really low caliber, verbose, disgusting, megalomaniac. I wonder how he makes a living, and just went on and on like that. So I thought it was probably best. I know how social media works. Probably the best thing to do is just ignore it, you know. So I did, or I tried to, you know. And then in the quiet moments, you know, waking up in the middle of the night, I would start thinking of clever responses. My favorite one was just to note that he characterized me with all these different words, but he never said anything he actually disagreed with. And so I was going to put a comment on there to say, you know, if there's something specific you disagree with me on, maybe we could have a conversation about it. Okay. I thought that sounded pretty good. My son and daughter-in-law were visiting us at that time, and she works for a large university, helping professors learn how to use the internet and media for their teaching. And so she's very familiar with all this area. And I said, do you think that would be a good response? And yes, she smiled and shook her head and said, no. It's just going to inflame things. So I said, okay. I kind of knew that back there, but okay. And then maybe about a week later, I woke up in the middle of the night and I was thinking about a couple of lines from a letter that Ralph Waldo Emerson wrote to his brother Charles during the midst of the transcendental controversy back in the early 1800s. And these two lines remembered go something like this. They say that the world is somewhat vexed on account of our wicked writings. I trust it will recover its composure. Isn't that great? And I thought, that's what I'll do. You know, I'll just quote Emerson. I'll put that as my reply out there. And I thought, you know, that'll be just like sticking a thumb in this guy's eyes, but it'll look like I'm taking a high road. And I thought, stick a thumb in his eye? So what's going on in here? You know, and I looked inside and there was rage. Full throttled. I don't think it was at risk of breaking out. You know, how we respond to this, what we do outwardly, I don't think is dictated. We have lots of choices. But feeling the rage, I don't think that we have a choice with that. And so I just kind of opened up to it and just let myself feel that. And I got to say, it took about 5 minutes. And I found myself grinning like an idiot. I was just smiling. It was such a relief just to have that feeling there without trying to cover it up with, propriety or something like that. And kind of what happened was when I didn't fight it, it just suddenly reared up and increased a whole lot and peaked and then just died down very quickly. And I thought, wow, this is really cool. And so I thought, well, is there another affective emotion in here? So there was a rage was part of it. And I looked inside and there was also a piece of this this affective emotion. It's called connection. I think I mentioned it before that we're a social species that really can't survive without these connections. And when a connection is broken, you can see this in an infant. You can get an infant who is diapered and well-fed and rested and just put it in an infant seat and leave it alone. Just leave it alone. And about 15 or 20 minutes, it'll start crying, right? And all you have to do is go over and pick it up, you know, and pat it and stroke it or talk to it a little bit and it calms right down. So what happens is this sense of connectedness with others is deeply wired into us. And when it's broken, what we feel first is panic. And then if the panic is not resolved or responded to, then it turns into grief. And so there I was. That was some of it. There's a fretfulness that I am very familiar inside myself that is, comes from my early childhood, and this little whiffs of loneliness. And so I just turned towards those and relaxed into those. And then I asked again. I felt like I was on a roll. Okay, is there anything else? Any other affective emotions in here? And no, there wasn't. There wasn't. Just beyond those two, it just felt like endless space. And there's nothing left but this persistent grin. And not even a definable self, just open space. So that touches on a couple of them and gives you a sense of how to work with it. I think with all of these. How we respond out there is not really dictated. There's lots of legitimate ones, but these are wired in. And there's no wisdom without, you know, recognizing them when they're there.
Can you talk a little bit about fear and
anxiety
as well?
Yeah. These are listed there approximately in their evolutionary order. So the seeking is probably the most primitive. And there's a little bit of seeking in almost all of the affective emotions. Then there's rage, and then fear and anxiety. And those are a response to some kind of threat. And it's pretty much what you imagine. There's not a lot of convoluted elements in those. The fear is different than the panic. You know, the fear is really a response to being threat. So one response to threat is to lash out and attack and draw up a whole bunch of energy. The other is to get out of there. And you can see how either of those can have an evolutionary value. Sitting still and doing nothing, you know, is probably not. Yes. Okay, good.
About fear, because I wanted to move on to that. And it's all the same conversation, but I really appreciated your talking about rage and then asking again and finding panic and sadness had a loss of connection under that, because I could relate to that relationship. And so I'm wondering if you've ever drawn, and not that you meant to draw a relationship or those two are interdependent feelings. For me, you know, rage is a surface affective emotion, or at least I've been explained to that. And then you go underneath that and there's grief, or there's this panic or sadness. Mm-hmm. And so with fear, have you had an experience as to I'm afraid, and then going under that and finding, you know, because we're not talking about there's a lion next to me. We're talking about, you know, fear that doesn't have a real reason, self-created, right?
Oh, and it can be fear about something that you ought to be frightened of, too.
It can be that, too. Yeah. But by and large, I'm well-fed and protected, so it's usually something that's not real. So have you ever, you know, what would be underneath fear?
It's not necessarily that there's something specific that's underneath it. These are all pretty deeply rooted. It's just the more than one of them can be triggered at a time, and the complexities of the human psyche. You know, we can use almost anything to mask something else. So you'll find obviously there are cultural biases. There are gender biases, there are all kinds of other stuff that get trained into us on top of those. But I don't think that the fear is necessarily wired in specifically with something else. Like, because I was saying, the panic and grief actually come out of a different place in the brain than the fear does. Yes.
Hi. Your discussion about the functioning of the brain from a biological standpoint is pretty interesting to me. And coincidentally, I've been listening to a lot of lectures by Robert Sapolsky. You probably know who I'm talking about. One of the points that he makes that sort of stuck with me kind of as a Buddhist was that, you know, there are certain things about the brain that are very hardwired. And the affective emotions you're talking about that come from the, you know, base of the brain are pretty hardwired into us from when we had to run away from tigers or whatever it was, but they're there. And he also made the point, people were sort of kind of suggesting to him, well, Robert, do you think that as we evolve as a species, we will improve or become more broad or more accepting or whatever? And as a biologist, he said, like, one of the fundamental things about the human brain, sadly, is that it divides people into us and them. And that's just hardwired in there. And I was wondering if you had a reaction to that statement.
Instinctively, I don't buy it. I think we are, that the fear triggers us and them a threat. But I also know, you know, in my own practice, and I'm sure a lot of you have experiences too, if you can get to a place of safety, and then rather than turn away from that person, kind of pull them into your heart, it doesn't necessarily get rid of the fear. But if you have a situation set up where realistically they are not a danger to you, if they're still a danger, then forget it, you're not going to be able to turn it off. But if they trigger something and remind you of somebody, we really have a tremendous capacity to step outside that and look at it, feel it inside ourselves, and feel some compassion, you know, for this person who is just lost and spinning in their stuff. Where the Buddhists make a mistake is they try to go too quickly to that. I think the first question is, am I really in danger here? You know, if the building is on fire, don't sit and meditate the fear away, just get out of the building, to really look at that. And then after, if we've taken care of all that and something lingers, then that's one thing we can go and look underneath it and see if there are other ways to integrate it.
So Doug, we've got a very engaged group here, but a few minutes left. Patty has a question online, and then Angela has a question as well. And then I want to save a little time for us to close.
Hi, thank you. So maybe I'm naively listening, but it sounds to me like you're saying consciousness is just the brain, and so once the brain goes, it's over?
Yeah.
Wow.
I am saying that. Okay. I am saying that. One of the hard questions, you know, and they call it the hard question, is how do subjective experiences arise out of objective material like the brain? And I think we're getting closer to an answer to that. And to play all that out would take a long time. But as you look at how the brain operates, there are places where, let's see if I can do this quickly, that there is no light inside the brain, right? So when we actually perceive light, there are neural impulses that are coming in. So we don't perceive anything directly, but it all is translated in this code that comes in. And so when we respond, what the brain actually does is it goes through all this material and it creates a model of what's going on out there in the world and what's going on inside me. And then it responds to that, and then there are feedback mechanisms that can update it. And I think there are just a bunch of mechanisms like that that make it clear that we end up with an image inside ourselves of something which maybe transcends anything as lowly as this material body. But I think, I mean, I suspect maybe the next few years, maybe the next 10 or 20 years, there'll be much more definitive answers. One thing I'm doing right now is I'm trying to put together a manuscript of writing up the stuff as I can figure it out. It's just I don't know if I'll publish it, but this is my way of trying to see where the holes are in my understanding of that. And I keep coming back to this. That's actually the question. The first book I ever tried to write was called Shadows in the Mirror, which was trying to figure out how it was that we created a sense of self out of nothing. So I've just been fascinated with this all my life.
So you don't know in reincarnation, or you think when we die, boom, poof, everything is gone.
I would not make a religion out of that, but my best sense of it is that when we're gone, we're gone. And you can see how, if all of us walked around thinking, well, when I'm gone, I'm gone, it doesn't necessarily encourage our DNA to be passed along to the next generation, you know, to believe that there's something eternal or beyond that. So I can see how we could get biased in that direction. I don't feel like I have an answer, but my suspicion is that no. In the West, we have the split between the material and the immaterial that doesn't exist in a lot of other cultures, but I think that makes us ripe for that. Although the Buddha, you know, his time, they all believed in reincarnation. I'm not sure the Buddha did. There's a line where somebody asks him why he teaches reincarnation. And he said, because it gladdens their minds. And a glad mind, a mind that's open like that, is just much more sensitive and much more receptive. But he didn't say because it's true. He says because it's skillful means.
Interesting. Thank you.
You're welcome. And I don't expect a lot of people to buy in with me on that, but that's where I am at this point.
So, oh my God. Doug, I wanted to say, since it's 8:30, I seek no question except the dedication of merit from you, and I will turn this mic off.
Okay. So let's just take a moment. One thing that's wired into all of us, although it gets scrambled, is just the desire, a simple, simple desire to be happy. And so let's spend just a moment and just bathe yourself in that wish. You know, may I be happy. May I be peaceful. May I know contentment. And then take that same wish and send it out to all the people around the physical room and around the Zoom room. May all of us satisfy our deepest, wisest yearnings. May we all know simple happiness, a sense of completeness, of belonging. And then sending it out beyond all of us, out around the planet, to Ukraine, to Moscow. To all creatures everywhere, may all beings know their true nature. May all beings know the deepest peace and well-being. May all beings be free of fear. May all beings be free. May it be so. Namaste. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for coming.